You all set? Okay.
Good. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Thank you for having me. Good to be here with you. You're welcome. Just came from meeting with the vocation director for Atlanta up at the center, and we have 13 guys from Atlanta. They're the number two diocese after Chicago. And the numbers are good. You know, we started this year with 192 students, and we had slid down to 158 at one point. So that was not good for us in all sorts of ways. So we've been really trying to move the numbers up, and I've been actively schmoozing a lot of, you know, the youth incentive team of Mundelein stopped for various reasons. Some financial, some, you know, otherwise. So I was very happy, you know, with these Atlanta guys today, and I'm very hopeful we get over 200 beginning of next year. And that's not a bad number for us. Around 200, it's enough to kind of keep us going financially, and we can also manage that number. You get much bigger than that, we have to really increase the faculty. And the Cardinal was great. Last year gave me a lot of Chicago people. So you know, John Karch is up there now, and Brendan Lupton, and many others. They said to me, that's it. No more Chicagoans. So I've been begging other bishops for priests, but of course they're hard to come by. So I think we get around 200, we'll be in good shape up at Mundelein. I saw a couple of you gentlemen, that when I came in, it was very moving to see the mural of Bill Quinn out there. Many remember Bill Quinn, who was the pastor here. And he was a great hero of mine. When I was the newly ordained, I was at St. Paul the Cross Church. Bill had just come from here. He had retired, and he was spending a year up there with Joe Kinane, who was my first pastor. And those two guys were tremendous influences, but especially Bill Quinn. He was 69 at the time, and I was 26. And I just met this old guy upstairs. You know, I didn't know who he was. And we started talking, and he'd say casually, you know, when Gustavo and I were talking at the council, and I'm like, hey, what council are we talking about? Vatican II. Which Gustavo is this? Oh, Gutierrez, you know. When Hans and I were discussing over lunch one day at the council, with Hans Kuhn. So I realized this old guy had really been, you know, around the world, and he proved to be this tremendous mentor to me. And to see that picture there as I came in with Bill with his hands out like this, and behind him all his great heroes, Dorothy Day and Cesar Chavez, whom we knew very well. I think Cesar Chavez was here for Bill's funeral. I never appreciate Bill's funeral, but anyway, it's a joy to come back to this place, which is so identified with him. And what I want to do is share with you, I'll do kind of a somewhat quicker version of this talk, but 7 recommendations for new evangelization. So everybody's talking about that. I've been doing it for the past several years now using new media. You know what struck me is, as I was going over this talk again, is how Bill Quinn these themes are. Bill got into me in a very deep way, and the things I'll share with you are very close to Bill's way of approaching things. So I just feel it's appropriate I'm here at his stomping ground, you know. 2nd observation before I start is this is born not just of theoretical musing, but of a lot of really practical experience. So I've been doing this work in evangelization through the media for the past many years. And the great thing about the media world is you find out pretty quickly what's blocking people. You know, the internet world gets you way outside the church, way outside the walls of the church, into the really radical secular world and people that hate religion. But you find out pretty quickly what's blocking them, what works, what doesn't. So these are born really very much of that experience. Okay? So to keep the score, I'm going to just talk briefly about 7 features I think are important for new evangelization. Here's the first one. I think we have to lead with beauty. You know, again, Bill Quinn, I wasn't intending to do this, but as I came down, Bill got into my heart a bit, and then seeing the picture, if there's one word on his lips more than any other, it was the word beauty. Beauty. Beautiful. The beauty of the Catholic tradition. See, here's the thing. In our postmodern time, that's the talk for another day, but in our postmodern time, there's an allergy almost to the true and the good. What I mean is, if I get up and say, hey, here's the truth, everybody. Well, our culture says, yeah, but you're... Remember in the Big Lebowski, if anyone's in the film, you know, when the dude says, that's just your opinion, man. I mean, but that's a lot of the postmodern sensibilities. Well, yeah, it's your opinion, your truth, I got my truth, but there's no truth. The good is even worse. If you say, you're not living your life the way you should, here's the good life and you're not living it, of course, people get very defensive. Trust me, now you all know that too, but out in secular land, if you start really hitting the good, people get reactive. But the 3rd transcendental, right, the beautiful, I think it's far less threatening. and therefore more promising evangelicals. Begin with the beauty of the Catholic tradition. What I mean is, like, this is big in my Catholicism series, the 10-part video series. I didn't even address the hot button issues. I never talk about abortion, birth control, gay marriage, anything like that. But I do a lot with, look at San Chapelle. Just look at this thing. Look at Chartres Cathedral. Look at the Sistine Chapel. Or in Calcutta, look at these Mother Teresa sisters in the midst of the worst slum in the world, radiantly joyful. That's beautiful, beautiful. And the beautiful is less threatening and more beguiling. But I think it does lead you, in fact, eventually to the good and to the truth. I think my example of that comes from when I was a kid, growing up outside Detroit, and my father taking my brother and me to the Tigers game. This would have been the summer of 1967, maybe. And it was my first pro baseball game. And coming up out of the bowels of the stadium and then seeing, you know, the bright green grass and the white uniforms of the Tigers and watching these pro baseball players play. Beautiful. I still remember it. I can conjure it vividly in my mind, this moment. It was beautiful. See, and that led me to want to play. So that summer, I started playing T-ball. And having seen it, I wanted to get in to play. Having played, I then got the rules from the inside. I understood baseball, how it works, and why the rules are as they are. See, that's an example of going from the beautiful to the good to the true. Right? It's splendid, beautiful. Therefore, I want to play. I want to get into that world. And then, finally, the true. I get it from the inside. The problem, I think, is beginning the other way. I start with the truth. Here's the truth. Yeah, people get reactive. I don't get it. There's like a lot of rules to me. But see, once you're in the game and you love the game, then you want to know the rules. So that our best golfer among the priests right here, the golfers know this, right? That the more you love golf and start playing it, the more you like rules, right? We like it. Meaning, like, show me how to hit the darn thing. Show me the right, you know, alignment of the shoulders, and show me the right posture, and show me how to cock the wrist, and show me how much shoulder turn is right. I like those rules now because I've moved from the beautiful to the good to the true. So that's my first suggestion. And Bill Quinn, look, beautiful, beautiful. Dante, the Sistine Chapel ceiling, Chartres and Notre Dame, the saints. Beauty is a good starting point. Here's second observation. Don't dumb down the message. Now, I feel very passionately about this because, you know, I came of age right after the council. I went to first grade in 1965. I came of age late 60s into the 70s. And it was the era, I call it banners and balloons of Catholicism. I never thought religion was serious when I was a kid. It was something kind of, you know, lighthearted and neat colors and things like that. When I was in grade school, St. John of the Cross, not too far from here, we had grades in, like, English and history and math. But in gym and religion, we had a check. Check or a check minus or something. Well, what it signaled to our little brains was, this isn't very serious, religion. It's not like one of the serious academic topics. Pero Vatican II, Bill Quinn again. Bill Quinn was at Vatican II and he loved the people of Vatican II. Vatican II was produced by the intellectual cream of the crop in mid-20th century Catholicism, right? Balthasar and Romer and DeLubach and Danielu and Congar and Ratzinger and Wojtyla and all these people, the cream of the intellectual crop, produced these great documents. And you go, I just gave a talk on Gaudium et Spes, such a great document. But the intellectual richness of these documents is extraordinary, and we shouldn't be surprised. They're produced by the finest people. Did you read, by the way, Congar's diary of Vatican II? Did you see that? Came out about a year ago, maybe. It's really good. Big, fat thing. And you don't read every word of it. But it's a really interesting, this is one of the smartest guys in Europe at Vatican II reflecting on the experience. Great intellectuals produce these very intellectually rich, beautiful documents. And then we get banners and balloons of Catholicism. See? You get what my generation received, which was not enough to sustain us in the long run. See, my argument now is that this was a pastoral disaster for us. When my generation came of age, what happened was, life hit us in the face. And when life hits you in the face, banners and balloons are not going to be enough to sustain you. Religion was seen by a lot of people in my time as trivial. the great intellectual richness of the Christian tradition was not communicated well to us. And that was a disaster because we grew up and life demands some serious answers. Think too, you know, not just in Catholicism, but mid-20th century English-speaking world, there's a huge intellectual renaissance among Christians. Evelyn Waugh, W.H. Auden, T.S. Eliot, Thomas Merton, Dorothy Day, even somebody like Fulton Sheen. I mean, just go down the line. Reinhold Niebuhr. There's a flowering of Christian intellectual life. And then something happened. Then we kind of lost our way. You know? I told this story, I'm sure you've heard before, but concerning my niece, who was a student at a very good Catholic high school around Chicago, and a very good student, real smart kid, and she's entering her senior year. And my brother said to me, take a look at the books for her coming year. So I went over the table, and there was a pile of books, you know. And it was Hamlet on top for her English class. She's reading the great text of Hamlet. Underneath Hamlet was Virgil's Aeneid in Latin for her Latin class, the most complicated poem written in Latin. Just an 18-year-old kid reading it. Underneath that was a big Einsteinian book of equations for her physics class. Underneath that was a big paperback with a picture on the cover, a big print on the inside, her religion book. You know. And I said to my brother, does this bother you? You know, she's reading Einstein and Shakespeare and Virgil in Latin, and then religion she's reading in common. You know. I told that story out at the L.A. Congress, you know, this big gathering of like 40,000 educators and publishers and teachers. I told that story and I said, stop dumbing down our faith. And they all broke into applause. I said, don't applaud, do something about it. I mean, this wasn't imposed on us from the outside. We dumbed ourselves down and it did not serve us. You know this, when the new atheists came, there's a post-September 11th phenomenon, and that's when Hitchens, Dawkins, Dennett, Sam Harris, and company emerged. It was really after September 11th. Because September 11th revived the old Enlightenment argument, right? That religion is irrational, therefore violent. So we can't possibly adjudicate our disputes rationally, so all we can do is fly airplanes into buildings and kill people, right? So in new atheists after new atheists, you find this old argument. Well, when these people have risen up, and, you know, their followers are thick on the ground. Go to the internet world, there are tons of disciples of new atheists. Okay, but listen to them. Again, Dennett and Dawkins and Hitchens. They are great evangelists, these guys. They are smart, they're very articulate, they are passionate, and they want disciples. We've got to at least match them, it seems to me. And we have to do it with some intellectual rigor, because they're coming at us with all kinds of objections from philosophy and science, etc. You know? We're not going to meet them well if we come back with a limp, banners and balloons Catholicism. This was back 5 years, maybe. I was on a radio program by phone, you know, up in Canada. And it was about Hitchens and the New Atheists. So the guy was a little bit aggressive with me, was kind of coming at me, and so we're arguing. At the end, he says this to me. Father, would you at least admit this, that you Catholics needed Christopher Hitchens to get you to think about these things for the first time? I just sort of paused and let my annoyance sink in. And then I said, look, I'm the inadequate representative of the oldest intellectual tradition in the Western world. The tradition of Augustine and Anselm and Aquinas and Newman. And trust me when I tell you we did not need Christopher Hitchens to make us think about these things. But that's the trouble. Are we able to summon our own intellectual tradition powerfully? I think with kids today, and I deal with young people all the time, high school, college age kids, 20, 30 something, they need good arguments from us, not just feel good stuff. So don't dumb down the message. Here's a third recommendation. Also, Bill Quinn, man, I just think of Bill. Preach with ardor. We have to preach with ardor. That's in John Paul. He described the new evangelization, and he said it's the old evangelization, which is declaring Jesus as Lord. So it's always that. But it's got to be new, he said, in expression, new in method, and new in ardor. Ardor, fire, passion. Remember Aristotle's Rhetoric, written of course, millennia ago, when he said, finally, people only really listen to an excited speaker. I've always felt that dead right. In fact, I had to sue the Moneyline read Aristotle's rhetoric. I mean, all preaching is rhetoric. I mean, persuasive speech, right? Finally, people only really listen to an excited speaker. If we can't get excited about the message of the gospel, people are not going to listen to it. Again, I'll reflect on my own growing up in the years after the council. Vatican II was a missionary council, seems to me. I think the cardinal's right when he says that. It was not so much to clarify great issues of doctrine, the way Nicene or Chalcedon or Trent were. John Schroeder said that. We don't have great doctrinal matters that we're trying to resolve. Rather, I want the church to become, he said, a more apt vehicle for the proclamation of the gospel to the world. Right? So how do we get the riches of the church now out to the wider world? And that's the image of Noah's Ark. You find it in Dulubach and the other these great patristic revival people. The image of Noah's Ark is, here's this ark on which a microcosm of God's good order is preserved. So in the midst of a sinful world, a bit of creation and the beautiful image, isn't it, of Noah with the animals, is the interconnectedness of all things. And it's preserved there on the ark. But the point is not to preserve it on the ark. The point is, once the ark comes to rest, it's to let the light out. I was thinking, what's his name? Kevin Irwin, who used to be in charge of theology at Catholic U, and he said, we all have that book, Gather, that we sing from, you know? He said, that's great. But there should be another book called Scatter. Once you've gathered, and you see, the church is Noah's Ark, isn't it? If we gather there and we realize a microcosm of God's good order, we sing harmoniously together, we listen to the Word of God, we're shaped, we're formed, we're fed by the body and blood of Christ, and then, again, the Lubach, the holiest words of the Mass after the consecration are, Ite Missa Est, is now scatter, go out of Noah's Ark, and now Christify the world. That seems to me, we got to spend now with that in mind, and it just opens up. That's the ardor with which we're supposed to go out. Now, what happened, and again, this is another talk, and we wouldn't be able to get into today, but when I think back on the church when I was a kid, it didn't strike me as a church of missionary ardor that wanted to bring the gospel out to the world. It struck me as a church that was often at war with itself, that was debating with itself largely over sex and authority. Again, we can't get into it. All people of goodwill, and they're important questions. I don't want to denigrate any of that for a second. But it seems to me it's half the church of a lot of its missionary partners to carry the gospel out to the wider world. You know? And I think that's the call of both Vatican II and of this of the new evangelization. This is a big thing in the postmodern context, too. Benedict called it the dictatorship of relativism. But listen to KISS. It's what I call the culture. Yeah. Yeah, your truth, my truth. Your sense is good, my sense is good. What do I do? What should I be passionate about? Whatever term you want. But it's Newman's image comes to mind here. Newman says that what gives a river energy are the firmness of its banks. If the banks are clear and firm, then the river's got energy. Knock down all the banks, what happens in the name of freedom or whatever, or, inclusivity, is the river just opens up into this big, lazy lake with no real energy. Everyone's floating on air mattresses. Our own little space, I'm in my world, but now don't get high, I tolerate you, but you tolerate me, and let's not interfere with each other. See, but what that produces is this kind of culture. See, where the energy, the ardor, the passion, the purpose, that comes from firmness of the banks, firmness of identity. And so I think that's what's going on, is both the post-conciliar period and the post-modern culture have, I think, sapped us of ardor. And that's what John Paul certainly wanted to revive. Okay, here's a fourth suggestion. Tell the great story. You know what I mean? Let me give you first off what my theologian's hat on. One of my favorite writers, and my favorite biblical writer, is N.T. Wright. Do you know his books?
Yeah.
If you haven't, just go. I think they're wonderful and very good for preaching. Anyway, years ago I read my first N.T. Wright book, and it contained this line. Is it Earth Begun? He said, the Christology of the last 200 years, both Protestant and Catholic, has largely been Marcionite in form. Now, remember from your theology, Marcionite. So Marcion, the second century Gnostic theologian who held that the God of the Old Testament is a fallen God. It was get rid of the Old Testament, hang on to certain elements in the New Testament, get rid of Israelite revelation. Well, here's what N.T. Wright meant, I think. Look at the Christology of the last 200 years, beginning maybe with Friedrich Schleiermacher on the Protestant side. Come up to people like, well, Kant was just before him. Come up to people like Tillich and Rahner into the 20th century. What you find on both sides of the Protestant-Catholic divide is almost a complete bracketing of the Old Testament. Now, I did my doctoral work on Tillich, so I can testify to this. You look at Tillich's great Volume 1 on God, very developed. Volume 3 on the church, very developed. Volume 2 on Christ, real little, real skinny volume. No, hardly any references to the Old Testament. Look again at Rahner's Christology, which I reverence in many ways, but look at Rahner's Christology. Nary a mention of the Old Testament. See, N.T. Wright's point is, almost ipso facto, that's bad Christology. Because how did the first Christians read Jesus? Invariably, it was Kata Tagrahim, right? According to the writing. They read him as the fulfillment of Israel. When you don't do that, what happens, again, this is N.T. Wright, you turn Jesus into one more spiritual guru among many. Right? So he's like the Sufi mystics, and he's like Hindu wise people, and he's like poets of all ages, and he speaks grand spiritual truth. Read now Deepak Chopra and Oprah and what's your friend, Eckhart Tolle, people like that. You'll find that vision of Jesus. But see, that's not the evangelically compelling Jesus. You could find that for sure. You could distill teachings of his and say, yeah, they're like the Sufi mystics and so on. Fine. But that's not what they were proclaiming. They were proclaiming that he is the fulfillment of the expectations of Israel. And that's why they wanted to tell the whole world about it. But let me give you just a real quick summary of the way someone like N.T. Wright does this. He reads the history of salvation as like a Shakespeare play, namely a five-act drama. First act, creation. Second act, the fall. The creation is somehow compromised by sin. The third act now, decisive, is the formation of a people, Israel, which is God's great rescue operation. So Noah's Ark, you might say, is sort of an imagistic summary of this. Israel is formed as a people who know God's mind. They learn his heart. They learn how to worship him aright. What worship does is it aligns us to the true God. Not though God is fussily worried about how we worship him. It's not for God's sake. It's for our sake. By worshiping aright, we get aligned properly unto God. There's Israel now, the whole history of Israel. Look at temple, covenant, sacrifice, priesthood, all of it was an attempt to bring divinity and humanity together. Right? Now, so that Israel might become the magnet to the rest of the world. So it's very clear. Look at Isaiah especially, look at Jeremiah, the prophets, see the Psalms as well. Israel's vocation is a missionary vocation, right? That by their integrity, they will now become the magnetic, attractive power to the rest of the nation. That's why you get Mount Zion, the true pole of the earth, there all the tribes of the Lord go up. Right? Well, not just Israel, but all the tribes of the world are going to go up to Mount Zion. Israel is going to align the world aright. That's its missionary purpose. Now what happens is the story of salvation unfolds. Israel can't properly fulfill its mission. So now the prophet's railing against it, calling it back to covenant fidelity, listen again to the Torah. Israel punished because of its sin, reads the Babylonian captivity the way the prophets did. Right? So Israel is meant to gather the nations, but is incapable of doing so. In fact, it's overrun by the nations. Act 4, the coming of the Mashiach. The Mashiach, the anointed one. When they heard Mashiach, you probably heard David above all, because he's the anointed king. Reread those. I just finished a commentary on 2 Samuel. Read those great passages about the anointing of David, and then David becoming king in Jerusalem, putting the Ark of the Covenant there, dancing before it. It's a liturgical move, isn't it? He's now the priest-king of a liturgical empire. It's the whole idea. and he begins to gather the nations around him. But how quickly that falls apart. Right? So Act 4 commences how? David, David, David. Remember in Matthew, the genealogy, you have 14 generations and 14 generations and 14 generations. Well, 14, with the Hebrew system of letters and numbers, 14 was the number for David, for David. David, 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 come. King has come. He's born in Bethlehem, David's city, right? Who is Jesus but the fulfillment of the identity of Israel? Temple, he's the true temple. What did you come to the temple for? Well, to have your sins forgiven, that's what Jesus does now. He came to the temple to be healed, that's what Jesus does now. He came to the temple for instruction, that's what Jesus does now. You've heard it said in the Torah, I think. Which is precisely why he can say eventually, in reference to himself, you have a greater than the temple here. I'm the fulfillment of the temple. He's a fulfillment of prophecy, right? Which is why he's the new Moses on top of the Mount of Beatitudes, giving a new law. He's the fulfillment of the Torah. That's why, again, you've heard it said in that little document, the Torah. We mean the highest possible authority there? Yeah. Well, I say he trumps the authority of the Torah. What's going on there but Jesus as the fulfillment of Israel? What's the climax of his story? Maybe we could talk about apostleship, open table fellowship, all of that. Is Yahweh gathering his people Israel? Right? The climax of the story, of course, is the crucifixion. All the power of sin, which has overwhelmed Israel from the beginning, now comes at him, the new Israel. So the passion narrative, you know, cruelty and hatred, stupidity, violence, injustice, institutional corruption, and all of it. It's like the whole muck and mud of the human condition comes at him. He doesn't fight it like the old David, but like the new David, he fights it by absorbing it within the divine forgiveness. So there's the dying and then the rising of Jesus, signaling his victory over the darkest powers the world controls. Which is why now Pontius Pilate becomes the first great evangelist by putting that sign over the cross, right? Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum. If any first century Jew hearing King of the Jews would have heard King of the World, because the expectation was when the Mashiach comes, the new David, he'll become the King of Israel, and thereby he will magnetize the world. Thereby he'll become the King of all the nations, which is why Pilate puts it in Greek and Latin as well, you know. So wonderful, he becomes the first evangelist. Now, who gets all this? Who gets all this in his bones? But this little guy, I don't know why I think he's little, but Shaul from Tarsus, who's in Jerusalem during this period and studying with Gamaliel, the greatest rabbi of the time, soaking in, as he himself said, the tradition of his fathers. Everything I've been talking about and a thousand things more, Shaul is taking in. Which makes him, of course, a great enemy of incipient Christianity. Now why? Why? Because the surest sign that you are not the Mashiach, if you're a first century Jew, the clearest sign would be your death at the hands of Israel's enemies. Heck, the Mashiach is supposed to gather the tribes, he's supposed to cleanse the temple, and reign as Lord of the nations. Pretty clear? So here's this fellow who was put to death by the Romans. Whatever he was not the Mashiach in Israel. And that's being obvious. Especially the Shaul is trained in these traditions, which is why he attacks the church. Until he meets the risen Christ. And now read Paul. Read Paul now under this rubric, and I think he opens up, lights start going on. He's now rereading the whole of his Israelite tradition in light of this figure. And what's his conclusion? I got to tell the whole world they got a new king. That's my job now. And now Paul opens up exactly the film. He's going to go around, first of all, the Jewish world they knew, but then beyond the Jewish world, because he knew from Isaiah and everyone else that the Mashiach, the new king of Israel, was meant not just for Israel, but for the whole world. Now read Romans, and forget about Luther's hang-ups and all that about justification by grace through faith. If you have Paul saying is justification is now a question not of the law peculiar to Israel, but of a relationship to a new king. That's what he's saying. That's where our salvation comes. And Paul's job is to say to everyone who listens, Jesus is Kyrios. Jesus is Lord. Right? And this is now a commonplace, but it has a double sense. It has a Jewish sense. You say Kyrios. So Kyrios in the Septuagint is the translation for Yahweh. You couldn't say Yahweh. You call him Adonai, right? Well, Kyrios is the translation of Adonai, Lord. Jesus Christ is Lord. Are you a Jew hearing this? You know what that means. But then you're a Roman hearing this. Well, for the Roman Kyrios, that was Caesar. Caesar was the Kyrios. He was the Lord of the world. And Paul's saying, no, not Caesar. In fact, someone that Caesar killed, but whom God raised up, he's the Kyrios. Which is exactly what Paul's in prison a lot. Because the Romans knew exactly what he meant. So did the Jews. That's why he's stumbling block to the Jews, scandal, the Gentiles, etc. Right? He knew that he was defending both sides of the equation. But that's his job. I would submit to you, that's evangelization. You want Euangelion, good news. Right? Because that term, Euangelion, was used by the Romans when the emperor won a victory. He'd send evangelists out with Euangelion, good news. Good news, hey, the emperor won. See, Paul and Mark and the rest of them are very edgy figures. Because they're saying, I got the real Euangelion. And it's not about Caesar Rome. It's about this Jesus whom God raised up, you know. That's evangelization. It's a very edgy, it's a very challenging message. It's always been challenging to the powers of the world. But here's my point. I'm sorry going on and on here, but it's the culmination of the great story. He's not just a wise figure like the Sufi mystic. I love Sufi mystics. I'm not bad-mouthing him. But that's not evangelization, to say, oh, Jesus taught timeless spiritual truth. He might have. I can get it, I think. But what's really cool about him is he's the fulfillment of law, temple, prophecy, covenant. He's the new king of Israel, which means the king of the world. And we've been sent, like Paul, to be his evangelizers, you know. I think now preachers, you know, how often we take that Old Testament reading and we kind of bracket it, or we might say a few simple things about it. I think it's so important that the church puts that Old Testament reading in dialogue with the gospel. And I think from a preacher's standpoint, to bring those two into the conversation is really important.
Which is your Old Testament reading, sorry? Old Testament reading?
Well, it's in the course of the year. So at Mass, we have the Old Testament, typically, first reading. I think it's massively important to bring those two together, to bring out this evangelical power. Here's a goofy story, but it helps me here. I know a lot of people over the years who say, like, oh, God, you know, Bob, the Bible. Come on, the Old Testament is so confusing, and these weird names and these weird stories. And how could anyone get in it? Isn't it better to teach the timeless truths of the New Testament? See, that's an insipid mercy, first of all. But here's secondly, I'll challenge it. A couple years ago, this young kid, 9 years old, she's the daughter of one of the women that works at Word on Fire with me. And in the office she comes, a real bright kid. And her mother says, I like the Star Wars movies. Show Father Bob how much you know about Star Wars. So the little 9-year-old kid sits there. And honest to God, I mean, I know a little bit about Star Wars. I can give you the three movies that I knew as a kid, but like the three new ones, I don't know that much. This kid though stood there and recited, I mean, like the whole saga of Star Wars. Uh-huh. And not just Han Solo and Luke Skywalker, but I mean all the weird little people and characters and subplots and names and Jar Jar Binks, right? The really obscure figures. So if you tell them, I'm just smiling now, and it occurred to me, don't tell me that little kids can't understand the Bible. If this 9-year-old can understand all of Star Wars and every weird little name, they can handle, you know, Jehoshaphat and Beelzebub and you know, the daughter of Jephthah. I mean, they can handle the biblical stories. This, you know, this was not that long ago. I was at the parish for a confirmation, and the pastor got up, and you know how you say to the bishop, Bishop, I want to present to you the class. And he said, I want to present to you, Bishop, a class of service. These are young people of service. Well, I mean, great. Who's against service? You know, everyone likes service. But, you know, an atheist, a Hindu, a Jew, a Muslim, all could be people of service, and should be. That's not distinctive. I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool if you got to say, Bishop, I want to present to you a class of evangelists that know the Bible. These kids know the Bible. These kids could tell you the story of salvation. You know, I think it would be a wonderful gift. So That's the fourth one. Learn the great story. Stress the great story.
Sorry for going on and on here so much.
Number five.
Bill Quinn. Bill Quinn visited me today. You must have. I wasn't intending to mention him at all. I just like, he's all over my mind today. Number five is stress the Augustinian anthropology. And you guys all know this from Augustine. Page one of the Confessions of the Son. Page one. It's the greatest line of Christian anthropology ever. Never been a better one. Which is, you know, Lord, you made us for yourself. Therefore, our heart is restless until it rests in me. Read 1,000 pages of Christian anthropology, you won't find a better summary than that line. In other words, we've been hardwired for God, every one of us. Every one of us has been hardwired for God. We're hungry for God. We don't want just truth, we want the truth itself. We don't just want particular good, we want goodness itself. We don't want just instances of justice, we want justice itself. There's a holy longing, that Ryan Rohrhagen's great line, in all of us, a holy longing that will not be satisfied by any of the goods of the world, which is why our heart, is a very interesting thing in Augustine, he doesn't say cordia, our heart, he says cor nostrum, our heart in quia domestica, our heart is restless. In other words, he's saying it's the one thing that draws us all together, despite all our differences. We've all got, in a sense, one heart, which is restless for God, you know. I think we need to stress it over and over again. I find it in my evangelical work all the time I'm doing this. It's reminding people that, I know you say you hate God. I know you reject the religion. I know. But tell me the truth. Nothing in this world has satisfied the deepest longing of your heart. Because I just don't, when they say, oh yes it has. Come on. And see, we know this truth. We religious people in our bones. But we have to remind the world of it. Because the danger of secularism, not just an abstract problem here, very real psychological problem. Secularism in its ideological form, there is no transcendent reference. And so I can find joy in the finite goods of the world. And see, I think, everybody, that's poison to young people especially. It's a poisonous spiritual atmosphere. Our job is continually to challenge that with this deep Augustinian truth. Here's the biblical image I like to use for this. Help me. In 1 Kings, the story of Elijah and the priest of Baal, right, which is one of the most dramatic and actually funniest stories in the Old Testament. So Elijah challenges the priest of Baal up on Mount Carmel. There's 450 of them and one Elijah. See, and thereupon hangs a tale, too, right? Is the avatars of the false gods are always thick on the ground. That's true today. Right? Those who are saying, oh no, find joy in wealth, pleasure, honor, and power, they're thick on the ground. Watch most movies. Read most books. Listen to most music. Watch most commercials. Most TV shows. But the priests of Baal are everywhere. One Elijah. Right? So they erect the altars and they call upon their gods. And that beautiful scene where they're hopping around the altars, they're begging, cajoling, asking, but there's no fire. And then Elijah mocks them. It always sounds kind of delicious. Elijah mocks them. Well, where are they? You know, they're gods. Maybe they're on vacation. Maybe they're taking a nap. I don't know where they are. There's even a suggestion in the Hebrew, they tell me, that they're in the bathroom. Maybe they're in the bathroom. I don't know where they are. But they're not answering. And so at that point, the priests of Baal get more frantic, and they hop around, and they slash themselves, remember, until the blood flows. But still, there's no fire. Then Elijah famously gets up, calls upon Yahweh, and the fire comes, consumes the sacrifice. He wins. But see, there's so much more there than just, my God's bigger than your God. It's telling this truth. Think of the altars erected to the Baals as all these errant forms of desire. Okay? And I chose those four, as in Thomas Aquinas, the four great substitutes for God are wealth, pleasure, power, and honor. Those are the four things we seek to be happy. The culture will tell us a million ways. The reason you're not happy is you don't have enough wealth, pleasure, power, or honor. Right? Because everyone's unhappy, right? I don't mean that we're depressed psychologically. I mean everyone's restless. Mick Jagger, I can't get no satisfaction. I try. Well, that's a very deep spiritual truth. You too, you know. I've climbed every mountain. I've swum the sea. And I still haven't found what I'm looking for. that's a very deep, it's the Buddhist noble truth, that all life is suffering. It doesn't mean that I'm in pain every minute. It means this, that I never find satisfaction in this world. Good, that's a very important truth for the church to know. The world says, just be patient, fill up the emptiness with enough wealth, pleasure, power, and honor. What does the Bible say from page 1 of Genesis to page whatever it is of Revelation? It's not true. It's not true. In fact, when I get on that path, what happens? I become self-destructive. Now I have the image of the priest of Baal hopping on the altars to the point of wounding themselves. It's a great image for what happens to all of us sinners. You said wealth is the key to my happiness. And so I hop. Worship. Strive. I get a little wealth. But then the buzz wears off and I have to get more. And so I'm hopping more frantically. And I get a little more wealth, but now the buzz wears off faster. Anyone who's involved in 12-step knows about this, right? And then before I know it, I'm locked in this very addictive, obsessive, and self-destructive pattern. Same with power, same with honor, same with pleasure. Talk to people addicted to pornography or to sex or to booze, you know. It's pleasure becoming the key to my happiness. Elijah publicly mocked the priest of Baal. I think part of the evangelical call of the church is to do the same thing. Is publicly to mock these false avatars. You know? Because they're all over the place. There are a lot of them around. The church needs to stand up boldly and publicly and challenge them. Elijah calling upon the true God and the fire answering is a symbol of what I'm talking about. The only thing that can answer the deepest longing of the heart is the true God. The paradox, as you know, is that God is love. Therefore, to be filled with God is to be filled with generosity. As the divine light comes in, I give it out. It's on the fly. All that. Okay, all of those truths. So the Augustinian anthropology, I think, is really key in the new evangelization.
But he killed 450 people.
Yeah.
How do you talk about that?
I think the Bible is so good, you're right, at showing the shadow side of things. That is the shadow side of Elijah's righteous prophecy. And which is why, right after that scene, he's dismissed. Remember something? When the tiny whispering voice comes, And the liturgical reading ends with Elijah putting his hood up and going out to listen to God. Beautiful. But what does God tell him? We never read that at Mecca. God says to him, anoint the new king and anoint your successor. In other words, you're fired. And I do think that it's reflecting on that. That Elijah, and that's our danger too, that we can become self-righteous in our righteous prophecy and thereby undermine ourselves, you know. So that's a good point. I think, and the Bible does it all the time, doesn't it? Because all the great figures, the shadow side is revealed in all the great figures of the Old Testament. Okay, one last one. I know it's getting into a little depression. The last one is the second one. I do have to stop. Yeah. The Irenaean doctrine of God. Going back now to Irenaeus, who in the second century battled Marcion, battled the nuns. I think, brothers and sisters, that Irenaeus, with Augustine, I reverence Augustine, but I think Augustine's got a shadow side, and we've been haunted by a shadow side for a long time. But Irenaeus, if the church had more fully embraced Irenaeus, I think we'd be in a different place. Now that's another talk I could give. But what's key to Irenaeus' battle with the Gnostics? His claim that the true God does not need the world. And what good news that is for us. Now why? God. God's absolute. God's perfect. God needs nothing. And we say that in our preface, right? You have no need of our praise, yet our desire to thank you is a selfish gift. Our prayer of thanksgiving adds nothing to your greatness. Well, nothing adds to God's greatness. What could? It's like saying infinity plus one is more than infinity, you know? Now why is it good news? It's good news because it proves that the world has been loved in the beginning. To love, I remember Bill Quinn used this line with me years ago. To love, Aquinas says, is to will the good of the other as other. Right? That's why it's so weird and elusive, and why we call it a theological virtue, I think. Aristotle didn't know about it. He knew about magnanimity or something, but he didn't know about love. Love is to will the good of the other as other. Because what most of us do is we will the good of the other for our sake. So I'll be kind to you that you'll be kind to me. I'll be just to you that you might in turn be just to me. Honesty is the best policy, etc. But that's just an indirect egotism. But see, love is this weird thing. It's a theological virtue because it breaks you out of the black hole of your own self-regard. And it says, no, no, I want your good. I see the point here. It's a metaphysical point. That's all God can do vis-a-vis the world, because he does not need the world. All God can do is want the good of the world for its own sake. So when I say the Irenaean doctrine of God, I mean this one, that God is not competitive with the world, but rather the most famous one-liner from Irenaeus, right? Gloria Dei homo vivens. The glory of God is a human being fully alive. See, in the old myth, go back to the Greeks and Romans, it wasn't true, was it? Is that the glory of God was a sort of denigrated humanity. If humans, you know, abase themselves sufficiently, they pay sufficient attention to me, then I might be pleased with them, I might give them what they want. But see, the biblical God is not like that at all. The biblical God, who does not need the world, can love the world utterly, so that his glory is that we be fully aligned. Now, here's the image for it, which I think is very powerful. When Moses is wandering around Mount Sinai, he sees a bush that is on fire but not consumed. Right? I want you to hold a contrast in your mind. In the Greek and Roman myths, when the gods come into human affairs, which they do from time to time, they kind of break in. What happens is people blow up. They're incinerated. Because the human has to give way for the divine to come in. But that's not true of the biblical God. The biblical God, as he comes close, sets the world on fire but doesn't consume it. He makes it radiant and beautiful but doesn't destroy it. Now, what's the full expression of the burning bush but the incarnation, where we say two natures, divine and human, come together? You know, a wonderful, that's not just a weird Greek abstraction. It's telling this biblical truth. They come together without mixing, mingling, or confusion. It's beautiful. Because it means the humanity of Jesus is fully itself. It's on fire and radiant, but not consumed. That's the Bible. Now, I bring it up because every day, practically, the disciples of Hitchens and Dawkins and Bennett and Sam Harris come on and say some version of what atheists have always said. The more you praise God, the more you are denigrated. To believe in God is to diminish your humanity. The more God is praised, the more you're put down. See, but all of that is predicated upon a fundamentally false view of God. And I keep saying over and over again, no, no, Gloria Dei homo vivens. Gloria Dei homo vivens. The glory of God is a humanity fully aligned. The true God. And we got to get better, brothers and brother preachers, I think, get better at proclaiming who God really is. You know? Well, that goes with me for doctrine of God. If there's one point I want the guys to get, it's this one, when I teach that class. I call it the non-competitive transcendence of God. That God is non-competitively transcendent to the world, and that's such good news. And all of our sacramental theology, by the way, is predicated upon that, so, so is our ethics and everything else. You know? So to emphasize this wonderful, life-giving, life-enhancing view of God, I think is so important. Okay, how about this one? I'll say one quick thing now, number 7, is on the new media. I hope you see, I'm strong on content here, you know. A lot of the guys at Mundelein, you know, hey, you know, Father, you're so involved with the new evangelism. How do I get involved in the media? How do I get involved with this? And I always say that before you even think about the new media, I want you immersed in the old media of books. I want you studying, reading the great tradition, because you got to start to say, you know, when you get onto the new media and start using it. Because you can use it in a very trivial, superficial way. Bill Quinney used to talk to me about, when he was at Mundelein years ago, back in the 30s, that the courses themselves were not very good. He never listened carefully, but his friends, who were smart, would get, like, the patristic books, and they'd read them, they'd put them in their lap, in Latin, and they would read them while the lecture was going on, you know. Bill loved Dante. You know, he loved the great expressions of the Catholic tradition. So, immerse yourself in the old media before you think about the new media. I'll just say a couple quick things about it. I would say it's kind of ironic that I'm talking about it, because I learned how to type with getting what he came right away, on a manual typewriter. Remember the manual typewriter? When I was in high school, we had this big clunky manual typewriter. That's how I learned how to type. I didn't get my first computer until I went off to do my doctoral study, so I was 28 or 9. So I came pretty late to the game, like most people in my generation. But I got into it in sort of a funny way, preaching, and someone said to me, why don't you, try to get on the radio with preaching? So I went down to WGN here in Chicago, and I said, I'm serious, what would it cost to get on the radio? And they said, well, we have a good time, 5:15 a.m. on Sunday morning, and it would cost you $50,000 for the year. So I, pretty much died, didn't get very far. Then I went to my parish, and I just told them, if I got the kind of money, I'd get on. So they did, they gave me that money. That's how I got started with the radio. It then branched out into relevant radio, the network. And then we got a website. And again, the irony, now I'm like, famous for having this website. But when I was first approached, and the person said, why don't you start a website? I said, and I quote, what's a website? I didn't know what that even meant. So, I got into it sort of late. But then we got the website going, which housed the sermons. Then the cardinal, took me aside and asked me to do this work in a more focused way. So I stepped away from the seminary and started working on this Word on Fire as my media ministry. And a great joy has been these YouTube videos. I don't know if you've seen some of those, but I've now done about, 300 of them. And they're commentaries on movies and books and music and popular culture and high culture. It's the old patristic idea of the semina verbi, right? That there's seeds of the Word sown liberally. And so the Word of Jesus, of course, that's our central preaching, but seeds of the Word are available all over the place. He's got the eyes to see. So it was a wager not to begin with kind of finger wagging or, correcting, but to begin with, hey, look at that movie. That's got a lot of religious themes in it. I think they were on Gravity. You seen Gravity yet? Mm-hmm. Great special effects, but also, to my great surprise, a huge religious theme in it, I thought. So that's been my strategy, doing these things. And in the beginning, I didn't know. We had no idea if anybody watched. My mother. But my mother still hasn't watched. But they slowly built up an audience. And what I loved about them was, I didn't know this about YouTube at first, but people can comment. And so the comments are coming in on these commentaries. And to be honest with you, 90% still, that's true, are negative. Maybe for people who hate religion, they hate God, they think, the Catholic Church is the work of the devil, etc. But I sort of like them. If these comments came in, okay, all right, I got a little traction now. Here's somebody, man, who would never come anywhere near one of our institutions. They'd never come near one of my sermons. But heck, I found him through Martin Scorsese, or I found him through True Grit or something. And now I got a little traction. All right, I get it. I understand the rejection. I get it. Here's where I think you're right. Here's where I think you're wrong. Here's where you need to be careful. And then, these conversations ensued. And now we just passed 7 million downloads. Right. So we've had great success on that. And as I say, it brings you way outside the church world. Also, YouTube gives you demographics very accurately. And we reach, for the most part, men in their 20s and 30s, which I love, because that's a demographic the church has a really hard time reaching. But I think that's a way to get them.
Right.
I told that story a few times about the Bob Dylan. I'm a Bob Dylan fan, and I've done about 6 videos on Bob Dylan's music. And this young kid wrote to me, 19, and he said, Father, I hated the Catholic Church, I hated priests, but I love Bob Dylan. So I was Googling Bob Dylan, and up came one of your videos. And he said, I saw your Roman collar, and he said, I just wanted to delete you and erase you. But I watched the video, and he was on All Along the Watchtower, Bob Dylan's great song. And he said, I liked it. So it led me to another of your Bob Dylan commentaries, then to a third, and then to your website and other videos and this and that. And again, when I ever tell the story, it's not typical. But he said, and now I'm in RCIA, becoming a Catholic. And again, it's not typical. So it's a wonderful exception. But that's what I'm trying to do in some ways, is to sow the seeds, and some land on rocky ground, and some land on good soil, So that's been a great joy. And then, of course, about the Catholicism series. That was born of someone saying, go crazy. What's your fantasy? If you're doing this kind of work, what's your fantasy? And I said, well, something like Head of Cart Civilization, go all over the world, show the Catholic faith in all its beauty, talk about it in a great location, etc. Make it high level, So I told my board, the Word on Fire board, about this, and they said, well, heck, that's what you should do. Do that. I said, well, I don't have to do that. Cardo's got to get on board, and I don't have permission to do it. So they went down. I love, Word on Fire is a very lay-driven organization. It's all lay people that have funded it and backed it and inspired it, you know. They went down to see Carl Jordan. And they sent him information in advance, and then he walked in the room. They said, I wasn't there. He walked in and they told me, before sitting down, he said, whatever I can do to make this possible, I'll do it.
Well,
so we had the Cardinal and I had the book. And now we needed about $3 million, which was, you know, the shoestring budget, really, for that kind of thing. And again, it's a great story, I think, of the church, is lay people gave us the money. And no funding agency gave us any money. We petitioned several, what do you call them, foundations and all that. Never got a penny. All came from private donation. And we eventually got the $3 million and were able to make it. And what I did there, I led with beauty. I tried to lead with beauty, lead with beauty, the beauty of the Catholic faith. And now, you know, I'm proud of being used all over the place in the church. And it's sold well enough to keep Word on Fire afloat, so we're able to do a lot of other projects. And what I'm trying to do, too, with Rector Mundelein, is to draw the young guys there into this consciousness. You know, so I've sort of declared new evangelization as the focus of Mundelein, to produce missionary priests willing to engage the culture in a serious way. So I've tried to make that, you know, key to it. Okay. That's enough for me. So those are the seven things I'd recommend in terms of content and method if you're going to do the new evangelization today. Thank you for listening.
Any questions?
Yeah, more than open to that, sure.
Please,
yeah.
You said to stress the Augustinian apology, didn't you say it was Aquinas that said the four false truths are well
described? Yeah. Yeah, it's the beginning of the Prima Secunda of the Summa. It's a really cool part, I think, to read for pastoral purposes. And that's the interesting too, because Aquinas begins his discussion of morality, not with the law. Remember, law is question 90. And I think thereupon hang your tail. Don't begin with the law. He begins with the attitude of, sure, what makes you joyful? And he says, there are four errant paths, wealth, pleasure, power, honor. And then he says, what does make you joyful is the true God. And then he lays out habits, virtues, and all that. And then finally gets to law, you know. But yeah, that's from Thomas.
And would you say that there's a top one, two, or three books that you recommend of N.T. Wright as an entry to
yeah.
that?
Well, you know, cool about N.T. Wright, he does both high and popular level. At the high level, yet his multi-volume is called Jesus and the Victory of God. And it's really wonderful. It's like four massive volumes. The new one coming out November 1, so in a few days, is on Paul. It's, let's go to Amazon, I think it's 1,600 pages. He also wrote a book, 900 pages, called The Resurrection of the Son of God. The best book I've read on the resurrection. The first set is called Jesus and the Victory of God. Also, The Resurrection of the Son of God. And then he writes a whole slew of more popular books. One called The Challenge of Jesus. One called Simply Jesus. One called Simply Christian. They're really good, I think, and for preachers. He also has treatments of the gospel for preachers, walking through Mark and walking through Matthew. Yeah, he's great. I love N.T. Wright. He had him at Mundelein a couple years ago for the minor lecture. Are you there, Michael?
Oh, yeah. There's another book, Surprised by Hope.
Yeah,
I found it
Surprised by Hope. Yeah. Yeah, he's a good writer. And he was an academic, Anglican, for many years. Then he became Bishop of Durham. And he quit, though. He was bishop for, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and then said, I can't do all this administrative stuff. So he went back to teaching. But yeah, he's really good. Anglican? Yeah, he's Anglican. Go on YouTube. There's tons of stuff by him, too. Tons of talks he's given and lectures, and they're always very good.
There's also books, too. There's some people
yeah.
do them when you drive or something.
Yeah, there'll be tons of audio books. Yeah, sorry, one.
Two things. One has to do with the ACP and how you, from your position as rector, how you can help us bridge the gap to help them understand
yeah.
the seminarians, and perhaps even the cardinal and the new archbishop, whoever that
yeah.
is, how that we can really help
yeah.
create this fraternal
yeah.
priesthood and intentional preserve it. But the other is.
Yeah.
In keeping with the authors, I mean, a lot of your approach, and I really like what you have said here, and it's helpful to me, but it's the contrast between the Ranierian approach that was so predominant in the documents of the council, plus other people, the Lubach, many others, and von Balthasar, who is really steeped in beauty. That's his approach to you come down on the equation of von Balthasar, but we were formed with Ranier.
I'm glad you brought that up. There's, I think, plenty of room for both. And the virtue of the Ranner Tillich, and again, I wrote on Tillich for my doctoral work, the great virtue of that approach is it is helpful apologetically. Because if you're going to try to draw someone in who's totally outside the church, a complete secular, I use Ranierian techniques all the time in my work in the internet, and the more Tillich approach, which is experiential and more psychological. Balthasar, I do think, is better once you're in the church, because what he does is his great image is when you come inside the cathedral, the windows light up. When you're outside the cathedral, the windows look drab. But you go inside and they light up. And he's the brilliant sort of master of explaining the lit up windows on the inside. So I think there's room for both. There was, in my judgment, a hyper-stress on Ranner. When I was coming to age, still, Ranner was the dominant figure. And I discovered Balthasar when I was doing my doctoral work. And it was like a breath of fresh air. It was like a new approach, something different. But I think there's plenty of room for both approaches. And that's a great Catholic imagination. It's more, inclusive, and everyone gets in, and there's room for both. And one of the ironies is, Balthasar is not very Thomistic. I'm very Thomistic. Ranner is very Thomistic. And I read it in light of Thomas, and I would quarrel with some of that. But I'm more Thomas than Balthasar is, certainly. And look at, Ratzinger. Thomas is conspicuous by his absence, in Ratzinger. Where John Paul is much more Thomas in his approach. So it's kind of a mixed bag, too, We all pick and choose and borrow from different traditions.
And is there a way that Mundelein really, with all of these programs that you have, that would be such a tremendous service to the church to have some kind of a synthesis between the two approaches?
Well, that's what I want. I want Mundelein to become a real intellectual center. And I think it can. Established a chair. Jim Perry is a wonderful Chicago philanthropist who established a chair in his name at Mundelein. I got Matthew Levering. I don't know if you know that name. Matt's a younger scholar, 45 maybe. He's been at the University of Dayton. Has written extensively. And Matt's great thing is symposia, conferences, bringing people to the campus. And that's what I told him I want you to do. I want to unleash you to bring scholars here, So that's my hope. And these young guys, Karchi and Lupton and Brian Welter and many others, I called them in and said, that's what I want you guys to do. I want you to publish. I want you to get out in conferences. I want you to make Mundelein a real go-to place. Because my hero is Hillenbrand. As rector, I got a picture of Hillenbrand in my office. He had Hillenbrand did, I thought, in his time. As he brought Dorothy Day and Chesterton and Jacques Maritain and all that to Mundelein. Good. That's what I wanted. And he got, the liturgy and social justice thing going. So he's my hero. That's what I want to do.
Marty. You led an office in the beauty, and that's one thing I really appreciate about some of your stories and some of your books and all that. Although sometimes I think some people kind of view that with a very narrow lens. I remember going to one of the seminars at the Church Institute about church architecture, and one of the presenters was basically mentioned that there's the only authentic form of church architecture is Gothic, Romanesque, or the classical forms. That basically about any of the modern things lack any beauty at all. And kind of compares bad examples of the modern to the best examples of the past. And I think one of the things sometimes we get a limited idea of the beauty of the occurs. Yeah, and it sometimes can be divisive. For some people, the only beautiful liturgy is the Gregorian liturgy, the Latin liturgy, and even closing the idea that there is beauty, and it's not dumbing down, but it's a different kind of beauty.
Yeah, and that's a good argument, which we should have. And I think you're right, Marty, suggesting that it shouldn't just be a
you know, the two sides kind of throwing brickbats at each other, but really have a good argument about it. Because I think you have to appeal to certain principles and criteria, and then let's argue it. Show me. You know, so here's an example of, let's say, contemporary architecture I think is really beautiful, and then make the case. So I think it's an argument worth having. You know, I agree with you. It's worth having. Please.
So I'm a pastor by myself, as many guys are. I have a school that takes about 20 hours a week. I've got lots of liturgy, I've got a lot of other personnel issues, all things. How do I find the time to learn some of this stuff, to do some of this stuff, to go out?
Yeah.
And also that, as you talked about, for lay people and going out and teaching. And there's so many things I'd like to do, and yet with the model that keeps the structure going, and of course I come from a corporate background, so I balance it, but just trying to make things, keep the parish close so those things can happen.
Yeah.
But I find myself often, you know, my greatest pleasure is being with people. So it took me like 5 hours to go downtown to Northwestern Hospital for dinner somewhere by the time I'm parking, I spend 45 minutes with her. And what did you do all day? I said mass and I did something
sure.
And that's a great gift.
Yeah.
But then you see all this other stuff there. So I'm thinking about how do we get these guys coming out of the seminary? How they're going to come right into this same model, be pastors in 2 or 3 years. How is that going to, you know, really, how is it going to, can we do something with the model? And I don't blame anybody. I mean, just, I have no answers, so that blaming doesn't help. But
yeah.
How do we do that? Well, I learn some of that stuff.
Yeah.
How to find times that are reprioritized or get relief from all the stuff that seems to be required.
I just heard George Weigel. He was up at St. Mary's in Lake Forest. And you know, his big thing, his big book, Evangelical Thousands, is we have to get beyond an institutional maintenance model into a missionary model. And I agree sympathetically with that. I think that's right. That's the Vatican too. And
how do we do that when we're
Right. Well, I think it's that you yourself move into that more evangelical missionary model. That your job is to do what Paul did, you know, announce Christ to the nations, announce Christ to your neighborhood. And it might not be such a concern about institutional maintenance. Or let other people do that. Maybe that's where you empower people to do it. And see your job as a Pauline sort of missionary, as opposed to Petrine. Now, I'm using both right there, Johannine, Petrine, Pauline. Maybe we're in a more Pauline moment. If Weigel's right, I think I do agree with him. I think it's an evangelical moment above all. But yeah, it's a complicated issue that I'm raising, obviously. But I'm trying to form the students that way, a missionary model of priesthood. But you know,
I was about it just yesterday at the dinner meeting. And we're talking about fill the shoes, who's going to
help yeah.
And we talked about all these things. Are we telling the guys who are aspiring to be priests that that was really involved? Are we just showing them the pieces of man's video and saying, well, this is great to be a priest? When Zoom needs the priest, they're saying, well, there's so much maintenance, there's so much work.
All the studies that show, and there's a recent one that reiterated, the happiest people in America are Christians. That was Time Magazine. There's been over and over and over again. It's been shown. And I think we don't embrace this. We internalize a lot of the mythology of one, you know, poor, lonely, celibate, unhappy. Where in fact it's not the case. But read the Steve Rossetti's recent survey to show that Catholic priests are remarkably happy, happier at a far higher level.
I don't think I'm poor or lonely, and I'm just not worried about that. It's fine. I don't have a problem with any of that.
But are you unhappy?
No, I'm not unhappy. But what I struggle with is, you know, you talk about all the things that are, you say go out and do that, but I don't have, I'm in a middle class bungalow, Bell Parish. I don't have resources to hire those people. And most of my family have two parents working, and you can't, there are a lot of volunteers, but some of you can't count on because some of you, you know, it's not their doing, can I give this piece? I can't give certain responsibilities the way you could canonically the bishop and all that.
Sure.
But we've got all this structure. You know, I try to make my yearly meetings and everything, but you put all that together and it's a whole system.
Yeah,
we just press real counseling. What are we doing? We're getting reports from various agencies.
Yeah.
Father, you know, what about the water meters? We've got to have this. And and all that stuff, and they're all necessary at one level, maybe. But the only person who's empowered to make those decisions for the parish is only the pastor. I can't just say, do whatever you want by this man.
No, I know. And because I face it now as director in a new way.
I know.
Where suddenly I got all sorts of practical. I spent a lot of my day worrying about roofs and
that's why we're running into a new one. You're being right. We can't just administrate it. I don't
understand. Yeah.
I don't probably don't want to be a pastor. Most of us, I hear about a guy who's 30, 70, talk about now I can be a priest again.
Yeah.
Somebody has to change that way of looking at it and the way of doing it. And I would be happy to go in whatever direction, but I would like to be hiding for some vision to help you do that.
That's the question is, are we fulfilled in our ministry? Are we just maintaining something and we're doing our job? Or is it really our vocation? And I don't know what the statistics are saying, I don't know where they're from, but the ministries I'm in are saying, well, I am very tired, I'm very burned out, and I don't feel like I'm really working the my vocation out. It's not, I'm not growing it, I'm being a good manager, but where is it going?
But tired and burned out is a different thing. I'm tired, but I'm not burned out because I don't find that what I'm doing is meaningless or put upon.
Yeah.
No, there's a difference there, I think.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
You think a good Catholic is going to help her missing one mass on Sunday? You think her going to help because they meet on Friday during Lent?
Usually.
And I thought your whole presentation was very good, and I think a lot of your work is really good.
Nobody
likes to be confronted in any way like this. When you talk about dumbing down the message, the Vatican II generation, and it's hard to, I think, is of the same kind of mind that we were ill-formed, poorly formed. You know, it's Vatican II was coming out of that era where we're going to hell for missing one mass on Sunday and eating meat on Friday. That was the Baltimore Catechism. Unless you experience that, not just read about it, right, that coming into the baseball field. I grew up in that era of the Baltimore Catechism. So when Vatican II comes along, now the emphasis isn't on the law, but living and experiencing the faith. And in our seminary training, not just going to classes and being a sport coach, that was fine, but we went out on apostolate. That was one of my greatest joys and formations.
Right.
Putting our faith into action, the apostolic work, getting out of the seminary and taking what we learned in class and being with people. And this is what Jesus was all about. Seeing the significant figure in the movies back in high school and college, different things that we were famous. So when I hear these words of this generation was dumbing down the message, it just breaks against me.
Naturally
taking the message and breaking over the
world. I make the distinction because I'm totally with you. Everything you set up to that point, I'm like, yeah, that's Vatican II. I'm totally with the Vatican II program and everything you talked about. If this is one feature that I'm quarreling with, the way my generation was formed, I think was problematic intellectually. And it caused a lot of trouble. Everything else you said, I'm totally with you. Totally with you, but I think there was a dummy down of the thing intellectually that didn't serve us.
And the seminarians doing apostolic work?
Yeah, of course they do. Oh yeah, all the time. They got field education, they've got the pastoral internship, they have CTE. There's all sorts of ways. Please.
Speaking to Ken's point, and I've heard you talk probably 25 times over the years, and I do think I've heard other people, I do think there's a grading because in correctly claiming that I have some of those books that you talked about going along the way, but I also had, and of course I was Quincy Nielsen, Jerry King, Don Grassi, John Schuch, Jack Ross, some guys in this room. So when you talk about preaching with ardor, and you say it didn't happen, I'm like, what planet? And so I do think your book, Bridging the Great Divide, nuances it. But sometimes your talks don't, and I do think it leaves the possibility that your very positive message, like your 7 points, and look, everybody's writing, and you believe me, they're going to be preaching it this week. It's great stuff. But I do think that somehow the nuance, that the focus was less intellectual and more pastoral, and that was a problem on the intellectual side. But some of the greatest pastoral ministers in history are the priests that train guys in our era. I mean, you're only a year or two behind me in the seminary, and Marty, I mean, we grew up under some of these guys, and we don't hear that, and I think that's where some of this, if I could say the word tension, seems to come explicit in it.
Yeah, I'm with you, but like everything you're talking about in the great Vatican II movement, that's what I'm advocating. Hillebrand, Bill Quinn, Vatican II, that's the world I'm advocating. There's a dimension of it that I'm quarreling with, you know. And sure, you always find, you know, exceptions, this and that, but I think as a general tendency, I would stand by the claim that there was a certain falling away in terms of the intellectual level. Exceptions, of course, that we can point to, all of us. So it's general trends we're talking about rather than, you know, universal claim.
And I have to say, as a convert, I was appalled by the lack of the standard Catholic from the Bible.
Yeah,
I was right to see the Bible study going on, see those groups, that warmed my heart. Not just my Baptist, but my Catholic heart as well.
Right.
So I think there might be some truth to that, but a lot of people are
yeah.
There's a lot of talk about the inability of children to read, even back then in the 60s. A lot, especially the poor, they couldn't read. And so some of those documents or books were put together to help those people move forward in that. And there's always a context, there's always an understanding, and it's a word that I think is so often used today to say that we are living with the under relativism. I think it's called perspective. And I think that there's a real perspective that we have to put in. We have to use that, the context. You use Bill Quinn, but the context of your talk, which was outstanding, I mean, you know, it knit everything together. It was a thread that really was very, very, you're a good preacher, and so you did that. But that's the perspective that you brought to this thing. And I think that, you know, we have to keep that perspective. We can't throw it all out. And I sometimes feel that that's what's happened. The cardinal has said to me, and I was with others, that I was trained in the secularized seminary, secularized scripture, secularized liturgy, secularized morals, and now that's been changed because of the catechism of the Catholic Church. When we had the documents of the Second Vatican Council, I think that that's a dumbing down of those documents to just say it's in the catechism of the Catholic Church, Bob.
It's a different genre. Catechism is one thing.
So we have the document, and then we have the catechism, and now we've changed that to change the seminary, and the church that we created is going to vanish. And then the true church is going to emerge even this fall.
No,
I just really wanted to know what has my 45 years been?
No. There's evolution going on where things are taken up, some things are let down, there's a critique, a counter-critique that goes on. That's what's happening. We're just in an ever kind of flowing conversation about it. With those banks in place, I mean, it can't just be a completely open-ended sort of Nietzschean perspectivalism. But within the great banks of the Catholic tradition, you find a lively, flowing conversation. And I completely agree with that. And I would never hold to an all-or-nothing approach to it. I'm trying to emphasize things I think that are worth emphasizing. And I know it's always problematic when you say, now, moving from A to B, because then everyone on the A side gets mad. I get that. And I'm not insisting on it. I'm just saying these, I think, are all good things worth emphasizing. And we take things up, put things down, the conversation goes on, you know. So that's how I see it.
I'm the only woman here, and I'm probably the oldest person here. So I think I should say that my family grew up in the banners and balloons era.
Yeah.
And as involved as I am and all the things I do, I have 5 children, and only one of them goes to church. And it breaks my heart when I see my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren not being raised. Oh, they're all baptized. Oh, we're big people.
Yeah.
They're all baptized.
Yeah.
But they're not being raised in church.
Sure.
It breaks my heart.
Yeah.
So I think what you said, you're taking it in the wrong context. You've done fine in your place. it was great for me. I learned everything I know from the people of what you're talking about, and I became involved because of that. But now, when you listen to what Bob has to say, it's bringing a whole new life to my faith, because he's bringing from just a little different perspective, and I've been able to change my faith from the way back when you had to fast and you know, fold your hands every time and go to mass every year.
And wear a hood on your head.
And wear a hood on my head and that kind of thing. I come from there through the Vatican II, which I thought I got in front of heaven, or dancing in the rain. And then to today, and when I have an opportunity to hear somebody with the view that Bob has, it gives me hope for my children. They come back to the church when they hear your perspective. And I would love, I'm going to get, I do have your set of the things you did. Yes, and I've loaned them to my daughter-in-law's parents, who's a relative here, some way down the line. And so when I get them back from them, I'm going to give them to my kids and make them promise for my birthday they'll watch it.
I think it
evolves from one generation to the other. I just happen to live longer than all of them. You just happen to live through all those generations.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that very much. And I think that it's an important thing. We all have to be critical of, you know, where we've been, where we are. We have to have the apparatus in place. If you had told Romano Guardini, let's say in 1965, that in 2013, 77% of Catholics in America would be staying away from Mass, I mean, he's turning gray. But what he wanted was to revitalize the Mass. Right. Read the Vatican II Fathers. They wanted to revitalize. So something happened. Or the fact that your five kids all baptized in the midst of a Catholic culture, and now only one goes to Mass. I think the Fathers of the Vatican are turning their graves over. And that's not what they wanted, obviously. So what happened? I know it's a complicated issue, obviously, multi-causes, but what happened is a fair question. And simply to say, well, wasn't it great and everything was wonderful? Well, something happened that led to that scenario. And if you know, it's hardly unique. It's my generation. It's across the board my generation. So what happened? What went wrong? What went off the rails? And I would say certain things went off the rails. Not everything. Certain things did. And I think the key is still recovering Vatican II. I gave a talk out in Joliet Priest. And one of the priests said, are we ready for Vatican III? And I said, oh, God, no. I mean, we're just barely handling Vatican II. I mean, even, I think the Vatican II dream is still largely unrealized.
Right.
Largely unrealized. So Vatican III, forget it. Vatican II is still very much on the table, I think.
Amen.
Good. How about one more? Now you have to go because I want to... How about
thank you so much. How would you say our Pope Francis, his perspective on the new evangelization?
Yeah.
And how does that compare to his predecessor Benedict or John Paul II?
He's
awesome.
Yeah, I'll say a couple of simple things that, you know, we're all trying to take it in. I think he's wonderful. I love that first interview, especially the, it's everything I've been talking about in some ways. I mean, leading with the merciful faith of Christ. You don't lead with the finger wagging correction. You don't lead with morality. I think that's dead right. You lead with, and it used to be Caravaggio beautifully, you know, the call of Matthew. So I'm totally with him. I think that's a very wise approach to the new evangelization. Also, leading as he does with the beautiful gesture, you know, like washing his feet and the outreach to the poor. And the, I think that's tremendous.
Right.
I reference Benedict. I think some of the best theological writing in the last 50 years is in Ratzinger. And some of those encyclicals and the Jesus books, I mean, are wonderful. So I'm a great fan of his. But Francis brings a charism to it that's unique. And I think very much in line with this beginning with the beautiful approach. I love the image of the field hospital, because that's right in this postmodern culture where people spiritually are deeply wounded. So, you know, it's my generation, your kid. These might be very successful people on the surface, but deep spiritual wounds. What don't you do with people who are gravely wounded? You don't go and take their blood pressure. I mean, you address the most fundamental spiritual matters, like the Augustinian anthropologist, you know, like the correct doctrine of God. I think that's what you got to do. So I'm with him. I think Francis is terrific. I was privileged to be there. I was doing NBC commentary when he was elected, and it was no one knew much about him. You know, I remember. his name is announced, and we were all expecting Dolan. That was the big thing. The channel, NBC, Dolan was going to be the next Pope. And we have all these cue cards in front of us. And then we were all just trying to piece it together. But that was the Dolan and what's his name, O'Malley from Boston, and of course, Ouled, Dolan, the usual suspect. No one had Bergoglio. And remember when he came out, he just stood there. Remember that? For like a minute. And I remember saying, do something. I mean, just... But who's, and then he started talking, and it's been this extraordinary icon, really, of Christ, I think. So, I think he's terrific.
Thank you.
Good. You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, God bless you all. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
First of all, Ryan.
Huh?
Thank you.